So recurring dreams are a well-attested psychological phenomenon. Perhaps you've experienced them. Your teeth falling out, losing control of a vehicle, being unable to find a toilet. According to Wikipedia, those are some of the most common recurring dreams. Well, Nebuchadnezzar's dream in the passage that Mike read a few moments ago, Daniel chapter 4, it's basically a recurrence, isn't it, of the dream that he had back in chapter 2. In that dream, you remember, in chapter 2, that something huge came crashing down. And once again now in this dream, something huge comes crashing down. This is a recurring dream. In both instances, it's the same basic drama playing out in the king's mind. But while that is true, it's also true that in some respects, this second dream now differs from the first one there in chapter 2. So first of all, the thing that comes crashing down this time is one particular ruler within history, namely Nebuchadnezzar, not the whole phenomenon of anti-God world powers at the end of history. So I'm going to call that the individual focus. Then again, the collapse that one ruler Nebuchadnezzar has here in this second dream, it isn't terminal. Nebuchadnezzar comes back from it and recovers his former glory. So I'm going to call that the impermanent fall. And then one more thing, the central component of this dream being a tree rather than a garish metal image, it's considerably more appealing and attractive, and I'm going to call that the inviting feel. So, yes, this is kind of a recurring dream that we have in chapter 4, but there are also these differences, and in those differences, it seems to me, reside the passage's main points. And so we're going to organise our thoughts this evening around them. And so, first of all, then, the individual focus. I said that's what we have here in this dream. Rather than it being about the collapse of world powers in some broad sense, there's this individual focus. It's Nebuchadnezzar who collapses. So imagine then those Jewish exiles there in Babylon. And they are presented with Daniel chapter 2. This dream given by God to Nebuchadnezzar, indicating that whole phenomenon of anti-God world powers is going to be demolished. God's earth is going to be free from every last vestige of that phenomenon. And that would have been kind of encouraging and exciting for those exiles in Babylon. But at the same time, it was so chronologically remote as to make it all a little bit unreal. There were going to be all these successive world powers first, one after another, after another, after another, before that great day of demolition would ever transpire. And it was hard, therefore, for this announcement of that demolition to really resonate with these exiles. It was just such a distant prospect. But now those same exiles are presented with Daniel chapter 4 and this next dream given by God to Nebuchadnezzar. And it too is talking about demolition, but not in this case a chronologically remote demolition, but rather an imminent one. The demolition of King Nebuchadnezzar. And sure enough, a year after the dream is given, King Nebuchadnezzar does indeed come crashing down. What's that saying then to these exiles? Well, surely it's saying, look, this sudden collapse of one individual king, Nebuchadnezzar, is a little pledge of the bigger collapse of anti-God world powers as a whole. It's a little pledge that that will indeed happen. The fall of Nebuchadnezzar, although not the great final demise of all human pride at the end of history, it makes that great final demise of all human pride at the end of history a bit more real and a bit more imaginable. And isn't there a sense in which the demise of an individual tyrant or an individual oppressive regime still in our world today performs that same function? I mean, in recent years, we've seen the feared Saddam Hussein disappear altogether from this world stage. We've seen Colonel Gaddafi with his lavish palaces and his seemingly impregnable position go the same way. What should we as believers see in those moments? Well, surely we should see a little glimpse of the coming day when the bigger reality of which these are just passing little expressions will be cleared fully and finally and irreversibly from God's earth, leaving that earth to be inherited finally by the meek, by all God's children, all the blood bought of Jesus Christ from all the ages. That's what we should see in those moments. When a regime comes toppling down, a regime that seemed like it was going to be there forever, a regime that was so proud and so self-sufficient. When we see that, we should be looking ahead. We should follow the lines of that trajectory to the great clearance that is coming, the great demolition job that is coming, when this earth will be cleared of all pride and all arrogance and all godless human rule, and the meek will inherit that earth. So that's the first thing this evening, the individual focus. But then secondly, notice with me, the impermanent fall. The impermanent fall. So why then do we have this departure from the first dream? In the first dream, the collapse of the image was devastating and decisive and irrevocable. In this second dream, on the other hand, the collapse of the tree, it seems like it's that, but it's not. Nebuchadnezzar, as I said, he bounces back eventually. And we might think, well, doesn't this detract from the first point that I've made this evening? Wouldn't Nebuchadnezzar provide a better preview of that coming bigger collapse of world powers generally at the end of the age, if his collapse here wasn't this merely temporary thing lasting for seven periods of time? Well, I think there's something quite subtle going on here, and I want you to try and follow this carefully with me. Remember how in that first dream, back in chapter 2, there were really two great realities depicted. So there was first of all the metal image representing earthly powers in their idolatry and in their self-reliance. That's one great reality. And then there was this second reality in the dream. There was the stone that brings down the metal image, representing, we said, God's special king. Now, here's the subtle thing that I want you to try to grasp. Nebuchadnezzar here, in this second dream, he actually stands for both those two realities in the first dream. So, the collapsing Nebuchadnezzar in the first half of our dream tonight, he stands, as we've already said, for earthly powers generally. And he previews then the bigger collapse that is going to happen at the end of time. But the restored Nebuchadnezzar that we have in the second half of this dream in our passage tonight, he stands, I would like to suggest, for God's special king. In that connection, I want to draw your attention to a key verse in our chapter. You may have noticed, as Mike read it, that there was a refrain that appeared three times. So it's there, first of all, in verse 17. Verse 17, it reads, "The sentence is by the decree of the watchers." The watchers here, probably angels. "The decision by the word of the holy ones," same class of creatures. "To the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will." There's the refrain. And then you have it again in verse 25. And so this description of what's going to happen to Nebuchadnezzar, how he's going to be with the beasts of the field and so on. Middle of the verse, "Until seven periods of time shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will." So that's the second instance of the refrain. And then number three comes in verse 32, where we have this voice addressing Nebuchadnezzar on the actual moment of his collapse. And it says, second half of the verse, "You shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and seven periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will." So you see those three occurrences of the refrain. The Most High ruling the kingdom of men and giving it to whom he will. And the very similarity then of those three occurrences kind of highlights one difference. And it comes in the first instance in verse 17. Because do you notice verse 17 actually continues at the end there? "To the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will, and sets over it the lowliest of men." That's an addition that we don't have the other two times. "And sets over it the lowliest of men." Now, what is that a reference to? In what sense does God give kingship then, the kingship, to the lowliest of men? Well, in the first instance, it's surely a reference to the humbled Nebuchadnezzar. After being out there with the beasts of the field for those seven periods of time, this helpless, unlikely, unattractive individual with his fingernails as they are and his hair turned into feathers and all this stuff, God is going to make him king. The lowliest of men, the most humbled man on the earth, Nebuchadnezzar, crawling around in the field, eating the grass. God is going to make him king. But doesn't that then point forward to the special king? The one who would eventually bring down the powers of this world, wouldn't he also be the lowliest of men? His very birthplace, out with the beasts of the field, so that his first cot is an animal's feeding trough. King Nebuchadnezzar was going to be reduced to a stump. Did you notice that word used a couple of times? A stump. After those seven periods of time, God was going to bestow kingship upon a stump. Just as centuries later, he was going to bestow the kingship on what Isaiah calls that root out of dry ground, Isaiah chapter 53. One who, like filthy Nebuchadnezzar, had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. Imagine a visitor to Babylon during, say, the sixth period of time. We don't know whether these periods of time are years or not. They probably are. But imagine a visitor to Babylon during that sixth period of time. And someone says, "Well, I want to show you something." And takes this visitor out to the fields and shows him Nebuchadnezzar there, crawling around, eating the grass, in that pitiful state. and says to the visitor, you know, he's going to be a mighty king soon. Well, the visitor would have laughed. That cannot be. It's crazy. The visitor would have seen in that lowly figure nothing royal, nothing worth taking seriously. Well, let me ask you something this evening. This Christmas time, you'll be taken in carol services and through the images on the front of Christmas cards and in school nativity plays and the like. You will be taken to see a baby in a manger in Bethlehem. What will you see in that lowly figure? Only cuteness and sentimentality, nothing royal, nothing worth taking seriously. Or will you see there the mighty God-sent king who will one day expel all evil from this world and give it as an inheritance to those who have bowed the knee to him? That's the crucial difference that divides us this Christmas, how we see that baby in Bethlehem's manger. As just this center point for an annual outpouring of sentimentality. Or this one humbled for a season, this root out of dry ground, this one who is heir of the nations, this one who is going to clear all his enemies from this world and hand it over to his people. How do you see that lowly figure in Bethlehem? I'm saying Nebuchadnezzar, in the second half of our dream, he's surely pointing us forward to the special king, to Jesus Christ. So the individual focus, the impermanent fall, but then thirdly this evening, the inviting feel, the inviting feel. So let's go back then to the first half of the dream and the collapsing Nebuchadnezzar. And we've said then that he's depicted as a tree. And as I intimated in my introduction this evening, it's an attractive depiction, isn't it? I mean, look at verses 11 and 12 there. The tree grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful, and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. This idea then of many nations being provided for and thriving under the rule of this king. It's a lovely depiction that we have there. Now, clearly, it's something of a facade, because we know that life wasn't really like that under King Nebuchadnezzar. We know from the history books and we know from our Bible that Nebuchadnezzar was a cruel king who deported peoples from their nation, from their own lands, and brought them to Babylon as exiles, having to live in a foreign place. And he wasn't a kind-hearted man seeking the prosperity of all in his empire at all. Indeed, that's why Daniel says to him in verse 27, "Let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed." He wasn't a man known for mercy to the oppressed. He was a man known for being an oppressor. But I want us to step back at this point and identify then something of a recurring motif in the Bible, because the Bible does kind of present kings sometimes in this idealized way. A classic example is Psalm 72, and you'll be familiar then with Psalm 72, and the title that we have above that psalm reads "Of Solomon." It's a psalm about King Solomon. And again, a bit like in verses 11 and 12 of Daniel 4. It's beautiful, the description of his reign. Verses 6 and 7, for instance, talking about him being like rain that falls on the mown grass, like showers that water the earth. In his days, the righteous flourishing. Again, this picture of a king who is bringing about the maximum prosperity and health of his subjects. Verse 12, he delivers the needy. When he calls the poor and him who has no helper, he has pity on the weak and the needy and saves the lives of the needy. Verse 16 talks about an abundance of corn, this fruitful rain. And so it's similar imagery to what we have here in Daniel 4. Now again, we know that the reality, although Solomon was doubtless a better king than Nebuchadnezzar was, again, the reality of Solomon's reign didn't conform to Psalm 72. Remember how once Solomon's reign has ended, Solomon has died, and the people of Israel have to go to his son Rehoboam, and they say to Rehoboam, look, your father laid a heavy yoke on us. Probably referring to the slave labor that he subjected many Israelites to in all his building projects. He kind of stepped across a line and became something of an oppressive ruler who placed a heavy yoke upon his subjects. Solomon's rule didn't conform to the picture, the beautiful picture that we have in Psalm 72. And so what is the Bible doing in this kind of thread that we encounter being woven through its pages? Passages like Daniel 4 and Psalm 72, this beautiful description of a king who facilitates the flourishing of his subjects. Well, is the Bible not deliberately touching on a deep chord within us human beings? Is this not what we yearn for? A king who won't be corrupted by his power and his status, and who will genuinely provide for his subjects and make them thrive and flourish. Is that not what we want at the deepest level of our beings? Is that not what so many in forgotten industrial towns in America were hankering after with the whole Donald Trump craze a couple of years ago? They felt forgotten, they felt marginalized, and they saw in this man a champion, someone who would stand up for them and who would bring back prosperity and enable them to thrive again. At an even sillier level still, is it not what so many see in the whole Father Christmas thing? This kind of supernatural character who knows exactly what I need and will bring it to me and ensure I have the happiest Christmas. And again, it all reflects this deep yearning that men and women and boys and girls have for this heroic king who will be thoroughly good, who won't be self-serving in the way that he reigns over us. And the Bible is doing this then. It's touching on this deep chord within us, in Daniel and in the Psalms, as part of the build-up, surely, to the arrival of that special king we've already talked about this evening, Jesus Christ, who alone does fulfill this imagery, who alone does fulfill that deep-seated human yearning. This tree under whose branches men and women do indeed find shelter and protection and safety and security. This tree indeed, who ultimately was willingly felled on the cross of Calvary for the sake of others. Isn't that what we see in Isaiah 53? You carry on reading. You read at the start about the root out of dry ground. And you carry on reading. And that root grows into a tree. And is then wounded for our transgressions, bruised for our iniquities. Remember the devil taking Jesus off into the wilderness. There in the wilderness, taking him off, in some sense, to a high mountain. He's trying to bring about, in Jesus' career, a Nebuchadnezzar moment, isn't he? Like Nebuchadnezzar walking on the rooftop of his palace and looking out on the glory and majesty of it all and feeling so proud. And Satan is trying to bring about such a moment in Jesus' career there in the wilderness. Look, Jesus, look at the glory of these nations. Feel proud like Nebuchadnezzar did. And Jesus wouldn't feel proud like Nebuchadnezzar did. And Nebuchadnezzar then, that tree was felled because of his own pride, because he succumbed to the temptation to look out on the glory of the nation. And this other tree, Jesus Christ, he was felled because of our pride, because he wouldn't succumb to that temptation. He was felled on Calvary's cross that he might be raised the third day and be a tree under whom all the nations could come and find shelter. Do you know King Jesus as the fulfiller of your deepest longings? You will search in vain otherwise all through your life for something that will fill that hole. Some tree with big branches under which you can take shelter. Some hero who will really champion your cause and really save you and really be on your side. You will search all your life in vain, and Donald Trumps will come along and will fail. And Father Christmas will seem to be as ridiculous as he actually is. And there won't be anything that can fill that gap except Jesus Christ. Come to Jesus Christ. Come and shelter under his branches. Come to this inviting, attractive, beautiful King. This King who will never allow his kingly position to go to his head. This King who will never turn on you and become oppressive and place a heavy yoke on you and make you a slave like Solomon did to his subjects. This King who will only ever be good to you. The King who laid down his life for you, who was broken, smashed with an axe on Calvary's cross so that you would never be. Come to Jesus. And may he be for all of us our King. Amen.